Session number 26579.
Mr. Clark, Reel 7. You're telling me once you were promoted to corporal in charge of a barrack room, you had to organise the barrack room detail. What exactly was this and how did you organise it?
This detail was you made it out every week and you detailed every man in that room to a certain job or task. Now, for example, you'd have maybe one chap on the fireplace to make sure that that fireplace absolutely gleaming. You then had to have maybe two men on the centre of the floor. It was pretty highly polished floors, all wooden floors, but to be highly polished, the polish being supplied by the colour sergeant from the company stores. Each man was responsible for his bed space. So, as I say, for example, you'd have one or maybe two guys on the fireplace. You'd one man on the table, scrubbing the table, and the seats, was a long table and two long seats in the middle of the barrack room where you could sit and read or do what you want or iron, whatever you wanted to do. Another chap would be assigned, or two probably assigned, to clean the windows, make sure the windows were clean. Another chap appointed to make sure there was no dust anywhere on the window ledges, what have you. Each man was responsible for make sure there was no dust on his bed legs or anything like that. So that was just virtually what it was.
I presume your role was supervised to make sure each member of it
every
did their
morning
job.
At a certain, just before we'd go on muster parade, I would go around and check all these jobs. And if a soldier hadn't done his job properly, I'd get a hold of him and say, come on, hey, get this done.
Now, what approach did you use as a corporal? I mean, there's many different ways of being corporal. You can be the men's friend, you can be a disciplinarian, you can all sorts of different things.
I used to look at being a corporal in this respect, that I would do the job from my experience as a rifleman. If I had a decent corporal, I mean, I didn't mind if the guy was strict, as long as he was fair. That's how I used to run that was my ethos, that I wouldn't let them away with anything. But at the same time, I was approachable. I always made sure that I was approachable. And that I'd have no qualms about putting a rifleman on a charge if he deserved it. No, if he wasn't pulling his weight, then I'd jump on him from a great height.
Now, were you Eddie to them, or were you
No. Nothing like that in those days. There was no first names in those days. It was strictly corporal, like, you know. And it was strictly, it wasn't a question, hey, see you, Jimmy. It was, hey, Mitchell, do this, or Thompson, do this. There was no, some NCOs did this, very few, but I certainly didn't, you know, because you've got to command respect. And if you start first naming it with the guys, then they could turn around and tell you F off, and you wouldn't have liked to stand on. That was the way I used to look at it, you know. Keep them at an arm's length in a civilised manner. And it used to work.
And did you have a corporal's mess? I mean, some regiments do,
yeah.
As opposed to sergeants.
We had a lovely corporal's mess up in the Buena Vista barracks. And we were lucky enough in this respect that a regimental sergeant major, who was a wonderful guy called RSM Elwood, George Elwood, he was very, very keen that the discipline within the corporal's mess would be similar to that of the sergeant's mess. And he used to always give us lectures. Once every Saturday morning, the CO used to come round and inspect the block on a Saturday morning. And as soon as the CO was finished, all junior NCOs had to report to the corporal's mess. And it was called RSM's Catechism. That's what he called it. And he would then lecture to us about every aspect of being an NCO. You know, from the barrack room to the drill square to the field. And he was such a hive of information and instruction. He had a big impact on us junior NCOs. And you'll find that the discipline within the corporal's mess then was very good. although we're all young NCOs, this Elwood recognised this, that we had, he had to instruct us. It's his duty to instruct us, pardon me, to become good NCOs and develop into good NCOs. And this was a tremendous help. And funnily enough, his son was made up almost at the same time as me. His son was in a national serviceman in the battalion, young Richard Elwood. Richard, a wonderful guy. Him and I became absolute great friends. And he hated his father. He hated his dad's guts. So much so that he wanted to stay in the army, but he said, I'm not going to stay in the army while that old bastard's still in the regiment. He said, I'll maybe join up at some other regiment. Or when he leaves, I'll transfer back to the regiment. But when he left, we never heard of him again, like, you know. But his son was really fine guy, very, very smart, turned out bloke and all.
So what was so good about George Elwood, I mean, the RSM? What made him such a good RSM for you?
He was a pre-war soldier. He, once again, he had spent so many years in India, Burma, come through Burma. So he had a wealth of experience of the human element, sort of thing. He had come right through the ranks, and he had this lovely approach. He was, although he was strict, he had a wonderful sense of humour. And it came over, even in a battalion parade, he would make some cracker funny. But it was in context, if you know what I mean. And I remember once he was drilling the battalion and his false teeth fell out. And he just calmly, out with his handkerchief, rubbed his teeth back in with his teeth, like, you know. And he made some funny remark about it. Everybody laughed, but then again. And he was a very approachable man. Very, very approachable. If you needed help, you could go to George Elwood and he would help you out. In fact, I think a lot of him rubbed off on me in my later life as a senior NCO, because I think subconsciously a lot of his approach to men rubbed off on me. So that was it. So
he was very influential. Now, what was the corporal's mess? Yeah, I mean, we sort of got onto that from that, but what was the corporal's mess? What did it offer you as a corporal?
Oh, as you walked in, there was lovely, nice and laid out, lovely furniture, tables and chairs and what have you. Then we had the bar, a nice bar there, where you could either buy beer, have a drink, soft drink or beer, or have a supper. They used to serve suppers, as in the rifleman's mess as well, you know. During a nappy break, say from 10 o'clock, 10:30 in the morning, you get in there and get your tea and wads. Everything was pretty civilised compared to what we've been used to. You know, we've been used to this dining room come canteen thing, but here we had the dining rooms and canteen, a mess.
Was it a hard drinking mess, the corporal's mess? I mean, you were all younger lads. So.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that because we all like to drink, but most of us were all, we were mostly all sportsmen. You know, we represented the battalion in various sports. And some nights we'd have a good old tank up, but it wasn't a persistently drunken mess for the very reason that we took part in all the sporting activities. In fact, another sport I forgot to mention was water polo. We had a damn good water polo team there.
Did you play?
No. I could swim all right, but I couldn't. I never played polo. But we did have a terrific team, and we had a terrific athletics team there as well. Excellent athletics team.
Now, did you have any other characters in there? Perhaps some time to have a look at some characters. You mentioned George Elwood. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Colonel.
Oh, the battalion was full of characters.
Well, tell us about some of them.
There's one big guy comes to mind, a bloke called Big Joe Armit.
Joe Armit,
A-R-M-I-T, Armit. Joe was one of these guys. He, once again, a wartime soldier, had been all through the war. He was in the army after the war just as a meal ticket. He became a dining room orderly, always drunk, and wanted to fight when he got to certain stages of drunkenness, and he could hardly stand. You could blow him over, like, you know. But he became a character. He was a great man. Another guy come to mind, Macaulay, William Macaulay.
Another rifleman?
He was another one who was a pre-war soldier, India, served in the battalion in India, 1st Battalion. And he came, when the 1st Battalion broke up, he came to us. And he was as black as any. He'd been out abroad so long, he was so tanned. But he was a right typical old soldier, right old bullshitter. You know, everything was by the number, you know, the number was this, the number that. He also was a right drunkard, always tanked up. But he eventually reached the rank of corporal, but he didn't last long. He got busted, and then he got to 28. I think he did about three spells of 28 days up the rock, with the military prison up in the rock. And he was one of its best customers. So much so that apparently when you went into this prison, you had a tea bucket. And that was your tea bucket, and you had to polish it till it was gleaming. And when you went back in again, if you had the misfortune to go back in again, you got the same bucket back again. Like, and apparently there was quite a bit of animosity over these buckets. If a guy went up there to do another stretch and somebody else had his bucket, it would cause a fight. Like, you know, that was the kind of mentality they were like, you know. Then with our company sergeant major, the wee Führer.
What was his
Sergeant
name?
Sergeant Major Galbraith.
Do you remember his first name? Or?
No, he was always just known as the wee man, or the wee Führer. He used to rant and rave. He was smaller than I am. Very small. Very smart, in actual fact. He was a 2nd Battalion man. He'd fought in the war in the 2nd Battalion. But he was always shouting and screaming and yelling at people, you know, to the extent that people started to ignore him. Just sort of sod him, you know, and they walk away.
He just overdid it.
He overdid it, exactly. And that's why he became a character. And then I believe in one occasion he was up in front of the CO for beating up his wife. He gave his wife a hammer and came in drunk one Saturday night and took out his poor missus, like, you know. But really, the battalion was full of characters. There was one guy there, Sergeant Doherty, Doc. And the Doc's wife was born and brought up beside me. Now, this Doherty, he came from, I think it was Lark Hall in Lanarkshire. And the family emigrated to America. And they went to, what's that place, the great, Chicago. He went very young there. He was brought up in Chicago. And he got caught up in the gangs. And he had to flee America when he was 18 to get the hell out of America because they were after him. So he came home, no job, no prospects. So he joined the Cameroonians. And they became, in fact, he became a warrant officer eventually. But he also had a hard war. He fought in Italy, France and Germany with the 2nd Battalion. But wonderful guy, he was a character. Another bloke you could approach. But I used to go babysitting for him before I got made a corporal. You know, I used to go and babysit.
Any officers stand out as characters?
Yes. Captain Bunce. Luggy
Bunce.
B-U-N-C-E. Luggy Bunce. He was known as Luggy because he had big ears. Now, Luggy came from here, London. He came from Fulham. He was a quartermaster, Captain Quartermaster. And this guy was so efficient, it was unbelievable. And believe me, when he walked about that battalion, when he shouted an order, you jumped. And this is gospel, what I'm about to say now. When the battalion left Gibraltar at the end of 2 years, the barrack damages for the whole battalion came to 5 shillings. This was totally unheard of. So much so that it caused such a stir that the Quartermaster General flew out from Britain to find out if this was the case.
And check up on it.
Checked up, yeah, because nobody had ever heard of this. because this man Bunce, he had such a grip on the quartermaster side of the battalion that nobody could get away with anything. And I reckon the barrack damages was 5 shillings when we left. Now, one night I was guard commander, and I'd been doing officer's mess, and the officer's mess was along the road towards the Rock Hotel, the big Rock Hotel, between the barracks and the Rock Hotel, the officer's mess, big stone building. Anyway, I'm guard commander, and I'm standing at the window. It was a summer's night, and the window was wide up, wide open, and the sentry kind of whispered to me, "Guard commander, guard commander." So I went down. "What's up?" He said, "I think there's a fight going on outside the gate." And I went down, and there's the old Luggy. He's got one of the other officers by the throat, and he's giving it real cockney. He was, "I'll knock your effing head in and all this, you know." So I just managed to get in between them and say, "Come on, sir, gentlemen, break it up, you know." The other officer was a wonderful character as well. Captain Major. So anyway, I went to...
What was his name again?
Oh, the captain was R.B. Parks.
You say he'd been off tape, you said he'd been a brigadier.
He'd been a brigadier during the war and fought in Burma. And at the end of the war, like so many officers, he could either leave the army, or if he decided to stay in the army, he'd have to drop rank. Now, he had to drop right down to captain. It was incredible. But he did eventually finish up a major. But he loved the army so much, he was quite prepared to drop 3 or 4 ranks.
And did you ever find what him and Bunce were fighting about, or were they just...
No, there obviously had been some argument in the officer's mess. And I think that the Lucky Bunce, it stuck in his mind that night, and he was determined he was going to have it out with Larry Park. We used to call him Larry after the film actor who did the Jolson story. So I never ever found out, but anyway, I managed to quietly break up the and Parks the next morning came to me and said, "Thanks a lot, Corporal, for last night." He said, "I thought I was going to get a right-hander." So I said, "That's quite all right, sir, any time." And that was it.
Any other officers stand out in your mind? You know, just as characters.
There was another chap, Captain Boddington, who was a 2A.
Boddington?
Boddington, as in Boddington's bitter. DFC, the Distinguished Flying Cross.
And what was he like?
Sorry?
What was so special about him? Why did he stand
out? He was the most unathletic looking man you ever saw. But he was always out there looking for athletic talent. And we used to call him, what was it, Wilson, Seeker of Champions. That was his nickname, Wilson. Because remember way back in old Dundee, there's a guy called Wilson, and he used to go seeking champions all over the world. Well, we gave him that accolade. He used to, as I say, he was the most unathletic looking guy you ever saw. But he would always be out there looking for athletic talent, like, you know. And always very, he spoke so posh that we could hardly understand him at times. You know, this kind of chap he was. And he'd won a DFC during the war. Although he'd joined the Cameroonians pre-war, he, like one or two other officers, had been seconded to the RAF. That, as a point of interest, in the year 2000, I did an article on this Cameroonian airman for a magazine. I did a good bit of research, and these two names came out, like, you know. So, having done a research on the guy and served in his company, I can remember him, like, you know.
He was your company commander, Bobby?
He was second in command of the company.
Who was commander of your company?
Well, by this time, it was it's still Major Greaves. But then later on, we got another company commander a few months after that.
We'll come to that then. So, well, that's enough characters for now. We'll perhaps come to some more, yeah. You know. How did life go on then from there? You're now a corporal. Were you ambitious? What was your plan? I mean, were you going to try and get promotion to be RSM yourself?
Yeah, exactly. That was uppermost in my mind, actually. Like, you know, that I was a regular soldier and I wanted to to go as high as I could.
Which meant RSM, did it?
RSM, commissioned officer, I didn't mind which, like, no. Unfortunately, it never came to fruition, but that's another story.
But that was your plan?
That was my plan, that was the basic plan. I wanted to go as high as I could, like, you know. But some one or two misfortunes on the way
we'll go into that.
The next big thing that happened to the regiment was that with the end of the war and the freeing of the concentration camps of the inmates, Jewish inmates, there then became a problem in the Middle East, because the Jewish immigrants were flocking to Palestine. And what actually happened was that in that certain part of Palestine, where there was a lot of trouble there, the 6th Airborne Division was stationed there. And three ships, merchant ships, left Hamburg in Germany en route to Palestine. Now, these were known as illegal immigrants, because the British, under arrangements with the British government, there were no longer any Jews entitled to enter Palestine. So what happened was, these three ships, they arrived off Haifa at a certain time, and they were refused admission into the country. So you're talking here about maybe 600 or 700 people on board each ship, maybe more, I don't know. Anyway, the British authorities ordered the elements of the 6th Airborne Division to go aboard these ships to be returned back to Hamburg. Now, they'd been to sea for several weeks, and were very old merchant ships, and were very slow moving. And I think they'd been to sea about 6 weeks when they were ordered into Gibraltar, so that the men of the Airborne Division could come off, have a few days rest, get cleaned and washed, you know, cleaned up and reissued new kit, what have you. Now, Little Bay Camp was emptied and set up with beds, mattresses, little bedside lockers, all sorts of goodies, tins of cigarettes, 50 cigarettes, bars of chocolate, all sorts of goodies. And we had to go out to the ships.
So they came back to Gibraltar?
They came back to Gibraltar, yeah. Now we, in turn, had to go on the ships and take over from the parachute regiment. Now, I forget the name of the ship my company was on, but I could not believe the sight that met my eyes. The ships were absolutely filthy. The paratroopers were filthy. There was no discipline. It was totally unbelievable. It was as if these ships had come from another planet. Anyway, we got...
In what way? How bad were they?
The ships were just absolutely filthy. And the inmates of the ship would just seem to be... It seemed to us at the time that the parachute regiment were having a whale of a time on there. They were virtually doing nothing, except maybe having relationships with the women. That was the distinct opinion. And when our CO went aboard the three ships in turn, he was absolutely livid. Absolutely livid he was when he saw the state of the place. And he, apparently, what we can gather was that when the whole of the para detachment got ashore, he got the commander of the parachute detachment up to his office in Buena Vista Barracks and gave him a right going over, and threatened him with a court-martial. But that was only hearsay. But we could understand it. We could understand if this happened. However, it was painfully obvious that we had quite a job on our hands to retrieve the situation in these ships, to get control back again, because nobody had control of the place. So, naturally, we had to be pretty brittle. We really had to be brittle. And what happened was, we mounted two Bren guns on the bridge of the ship with searchlights, because the decks, where we, the decks, the actual decks had been taken out, and it was all metal frames so that you could see down into the holds. You actually saw into the holds where all these Jewish immigrants were living, like, you know. And they spared us nothing. It was life in the raw, really. Anyway, one incident happened the second day I was on board there. I was on patrol on the deck, just checking everything. And there was two water things, water pumps, where twice a day the immigrants could come out and fill up their buckets and what have you with water, take them down below. And that's the only time we were allowed on deck. They were Saturday morning, but not being going on deck. But we wouldn't allow them to go on deck. And one incident happened as I'm walking towards this water thing. This man, he pushed a little child there, was filling her bucket. And this guy, he just got his arm and he smacked her right in the face, knocked her right away from the well. So I just casually walked over and I belted him with the butt of my Sten gun. And he split his head wide open. And I said, right, get him out of here. Got to be a girl. And this one of the guys said, well, I'll take this guy to the hospital. I said, bollocks, leave him. Get this little girl. Get her down to the sick bay and get her fixed up. And there was acts of this kind of thing happening. But then it only lasted about a day or so. When the Jews realised it, we weren't any nonsense. They started to fall in line, like, you know. And this R.B. Parks, Captain Parks, whom I know was of a Jewish extraction, he was responsible for mounting the Bren guns on the ship. And he said to the gunners, he said, any one of these people make a wrong move, he said, just put a burst into the hole, he said. Let them know who's boss. Now, that's how bad things were, like, you know. Anyway, we were on these ships for about a week.
Was there any actual trouble? I mean, there was no need to open fire.
They tried to cause trouble, but we nipped it in the bud straight away. Our CO told us to spare nobody. Any signs of trouble, to crush it straight away.
Well, they didn't have to, so, you know, and they didn't open up fire.
No.
Nothing too serious happened.
They got the message. They got the message.